Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A quick reminder, we are Zooming this show on Thursday morning, so if something should happen on Thursday night, we'll be discussing it on Monday. We have now begun our show with a bit of political verse. I remember always loving Calvin Trillin in The Nation, and we found our own political guy who will write limericks for us. So I'm going to say to my producers, hit it, gang, with the
Istanbul
music.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
If you look at poor Donald's Twitter, you'll see that he's gotten more bitter, tweeting election denial and conspiracies vile. He's a prolific fiction emitter.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
And now if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. He is actually more exhausted than Arnie Arneson because he has to cover a state that's the size of a country.
That's right.
I unfortunately have to cover all 50 states, but that means I have to do very little compared to him because you focus on such a changing dynamic in Texas. And I am so grateful that you're here, Mr. Braddock. My favorite story of all of them was the fact that Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is offering up to $1 million for evidence of voter fraud. What is his problem? I mean, first of all, where's the cash coming from? Did he do a GoFundMe?
It's his campaign account. He's a statewide office holder in Texas, Arnie. He has $15 million in the bank.
He knows he's going to get interest on that $1 million because they're not going to come up with the fraud.
Well, he didn't spend very much while others, and I want to make this point.
Yeah.
If he's able to afford up to $1 million for evidence of voter fraud, which it should tell you something that he has to offer money to try to uncover any. As people are saying that there is no widespread voter fraud. President Trump's own lawyers in front of a judge said they had no evidence of voter fraud, and I'll read some of that to you in just a second. If the lieutenant governor has money for this, while Governor Abbott, Texans for Lawsuit Reform, the Associated Republicans of Texas, and other allied organizations were spending millions and millions of dollars to try to reelect Texas House members who are Republicans, the lieutenant governor was contributing in kind, $101.94 to each of them who were in competitive races in the form of Twitter videos in which he endorsed those candidates.
Are you kidding me? Oh my, this is.
He has $15 million in the bank. And I can tell you, some Republicans were grumbling about the fact that he did nothing to help them when they were in, you know, these competitive races. When Governor Abbott, to his credit, was spending, I think, somewhere on the order of about $6 million. Some of those other groups that I mentioned, one of them spent $11 million, another one did probably $4 or $5 million, something like that. But the lieutenant governor, I saw it on his campaign finance report that he had given $101.94 to all these candidates. So I reached out to his campaign and said, what was that? Am I reading this wrong? And it turned out that it was the production costs for making the social media videos that they put out where he endorsed various Republican candidates.
Oh,
he was very magnanimous.
Yeah. So you saw Karl Rove. Again, I want to remind everyone.
His support of his fellow Republicans.
Right. Karl Rove today basically said it's over. I mean, he actually wrote
an
op-ed. And I was just like, and I'm remembering you talking about Karl Rove sort of having a come to Jesus conversation with the Republican Party in Texas, telling them to sober up, to get to work. They have to really sort of protect the bottom of the ballot. And now you've got Karl Rove basically sort of suggesting to Donald Trump that the election is over.
Well, and Rove, I went back, Arnie, and I watched a clip of Rove on Fox News Channel on Saturday when the election was called for Biden. And remember, it wasn't just the liberal media. It wasn't just CNN. It wasn't just the Associated Press or MSNBC or NBC News or ABC or any of them. Fox News Channel was also one of the first to go ahead and call it for Biden. And we should clear one thing up. When the media calls it, quote unquote, what that means is they're not deciding anything. They're not deciding the election. The media doesn't do that. When all these guys like Trump and the rest say the media doesn't decide who wins elections, of course not. What the media is doing is reporting on the result, right? They have seen enough. They have seen enough numbers to say this candidate's not going to come back from the brink here. Now, let's make it clear. When the folks like Senator Cruz and Dan Patrick and others, they try to argue, well, this is like Florida in 2000, almost, which is crazy to think, Arnie, that's 20 years ago, but it is. I think Rove made this point in his Wall Street Journal piece. It was about 500 votes in one state that they were arguing about. And when they did the recounts, President, and at the time, Governor Bush, then President Bush, he was winning those recounts. One Republican pointed this out yesterday. If Gore had won his home state of Tennessee, it wouldn't have mattered. But that's for another day. Anyway, remember they were putting out these T-shirts that said, it was the Gore-Lieberman ticket at the time, and people were putting out those images that said Sore Loserman as their logo. The Washington Examiner, which is not a liberal newspaper, they had a piece yesterday. The title was that Trump is a more sore loser than Al Gore. Back in 2000, it was about 500 votes in one state, in Florida. What they're looking at right now is nothing like that. We're talking about tens of thousands of votes that are spread out across five states, and Trump would have to win in at least three of those states to be able to win. I think in Michigan, it was around 148,000 votes at last check that Trump was behind. In Wisconsin, he's behind by 10,000 votes, something like that. In one of the others, it was 13,000 votes. And when you talk about recounts, which a recount doesn't mean that there's some sort of a fraud. The reason that an automatic recount or that a candidate can request a recount is because it's a very close result, and going back and taking another look at it might achieve some different result. And usually you would see any kind of a change happen if it was an election that was decided by maybe 200 votes or 300 votes. And it turns out that some of them weren't legitimate, or they miscounted them. I mean, that's totally possible. And that's why you would have a recount. They're starting the recount in Georgia.
Hand recount of anything.
But in Georgia, it was more than 10,000 votes as well, difference, right? So they'd have to find a lot that was different. The Republican Secretary of State in Georgia has said no fraud. The Lieutenant Governor in Georgia, I saw he was interviewed on CNN the other day. He said that he's been vigilant to try to find out if there was any fraud, and he has not heard anything so far to suggest that there was real fraud in Georgia. The senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, the very junior senator, Ted Cruz, Republican of Ted Cruz, was arguing on a show called Louder with Crowder. Have you seen this?
Never.
This guy, Stephen Crowder, I hadn't seen it, but this guy was doing his podcast. It looked like he was wearing silk pajamas, which maybe I should start doing for the podcast that I do. It looked pretty comfortable. Senator Cruz was calling in on a Zoom call like we're doing now. And Cruz is so good at talking about this stuff, right? He's such a smart lawyer.
Right.
And I always give him credit for that. Constitutional expert, all of that. And Cruz was on the legal team when Bush versus Gore was argued 20 years ago. He was also on the transition team with a friend of mine from Houston for Governor Bush and then President Bush. What Cruz had argued on Louder with Crowder in his silk pajamas, Cruz had said that the evidence that matters is what's offered in court. And he went on to say that, you know, we don't argue these things out on Twitter or in Zoom calls or on television or on YouTube or whatever. Cruz is setting up an argument by which he, Cruz, does not have to offer any evidence. He's saying that it needs to be presented in court. So it's fair to look at what was said in court. And if you're a lawyer, if you are an officer of the court, you are duty bound to tell the truth when a judge asks you a direct question, right? It doesn't mean just that you might lose the case. It might mean you can't do your job in the court anymore, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't tell the truth. So I go to PhillyMag.com, the Philadelphia magazine. Headline, Trump lawyer to Pennsylvania judge. Nope, I've got no evidence of voter fraud. Let me read from the, and you know, Arnie, sometimes when we talk about things that happen in court, what do you have to do? You have to bring in a legal analyst to explain what they're saying because it can seem kind of arcane to people. It's all in legalese and who even knows what they said. In this case, you do not have to do that. Here's what the judge asked. Quote, I'm asking you a specific question and I'm looking for a specific answer. Are you claiming that there is any fraud in connection with these 592 disputed ballots? Here is the quote from Trump's attorney. Quote, to my knowledge at present, no, unquote. Then the judge asked this. And by the way, there's similar situations in other courtrooms as Trump's legal team has been trying to challenge these results. The judge followed up and asked this. Are you claiming there's any undue or improper influence upon the elector with respect to these 592 ballots? Here's the quote from the lawyer. Quote, to my knowledge at present, no. So when Cruz says that what matters is what happens in court, all you have to do is look at what happened in court. His own attorneys say they don't have any evidence of voter fraud. If you watched Fox News Channel, some of what gets said there, not all, but Fox News Channel, if you watched Louder with Crowder, which I did, If you watch what gets said by Senator Cruz, if you watch what's being said by Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, you watch what's being said by all these people, you would think that democracy was unraveling, that, you know, we live in a third world nation where the election's being stolen. But if you listen to what was said in court, they have no evidence of voter fraud to offer to anybody. And Cruz later said, and he was trying to set the expectation for these folks, he said that, look, it's a tough uphill climb. They would have to run the table in all of these states and all these court challenges and in the recounts in Georgia to be able to even have a shot of President Trump making this up. Let's be honest about what's going on here, Arnie. The Trump base is the Republican base, and the people who are still in office as Republicans still have to deal with this base. While the president, you know, for the next couple of months, the president is going to cling to, he says, is a fight that he needs to wage on behalf of 70 million people or however many voted for him. Whether he decides to concede or not, we'll see. There was some reporting that Jared Kushner and Melania Trump had both privately said to the president, it's time to figure out a way to concede gracefully and move on. But President Trump, it has been reported, he's thinking about running for president again in 2024, which could happen. He could run again and be president again if people decided to do that. You would have to think that he would not only be, you know, if he ran, there would probably be a field of people who would run as Republicans to take on the president at the time, Joe Biden, or if Joe Biden decides to step aside and it's an open seat, that's a different question. I would imagine that President Trump would at least start as the front runner in the Republican field because, you know, for now, the Republican base is the Trump base.
I have a project for the Lincoln Project. What you just read to me about the Trump lawyers in court, I think that needs to be turned into a video ad. I think, no, I'm dead serious.
I think they should do a dramatic.
Yes, a dramatic reading.
A dramatization of what.
Exactly. Please, God. And let everyone
know, court.
These are Trump's lawyers. This is not a one-off. This and almost you go from one state to one case to another case where you keep hearing, no, we have no evidence of fraud. And that needs to be done. And I'm going to do a scream out to the Lincoln Project. Before you shut your doors, before you walk away, this is the material that needs to be delivered. It needs to be delivered around the country, not in the blue states, but in the red states. And just say out of the mouths of the attorneys on the Trump payroll, everyone, this is what is being asked by the judge. And this is the answer. This is the reason why. What is it? 71% of the American people think that Donald Trump lost. 71%. That's a huge number. Well, this number needs to be reinforced by what's happening in court because we need to be able to move on. And so does the Republican Party. Now, I don't know if you saw the story at Raw Story. Have you seen this? So Raw Story had an article, and the article at Raw Story was saying that Trump plans to wreck Fox as revenge for election night coverage and start his own media company. Because you just mentioned what was happening on Fox.
Yeah.
So I retweeted the story out from Raw Story, and I wrote, go for it, Donald. Murdoch will win. He delivered for you, and he will bury you. This is what is happening. This is the war that Donald Trump wants to embrace. Mm-hmm. I invite him to do it. Wall Street Journal, New York Post, you know, Fox News. You know what Murdoch has, as you pointed out, that Donald Trump doesn't have? A legacy of success. And Donald has a legacy of failure.
Well, Murdoch and Fox News did get bent to the will of Trump. Remember, during the 2016 primary, Republicans, Trump was not their guy. They wanted someone like Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio, probably more toward Cruz with a lot of their evening hosts like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and people like that. Although I can't remember if Tucker Carlson was on or if Bill O'Reilly had been run out of there yet. They had a few people who had problems at Fox News Channel. You know, in the meantime, they have had to think about what is the future of their business. As somebody put it to me the other day, a very sharp observer said, when you have an audience that is averaging above 60 years old and they are aging out of, the very cynical thing is to say that these are folks who are going to die soon. And so you need to be thinking about the future of your audience, but they're also aging out of consumerism.
Right.
Fox News has an audience that's not,
they don't buy things,
aren't consumers, right? So they're not the right target demographic for people who, for companies who are trying to sell things. That's a problem for your business model. Within the Murdoch family, I think it's been reported that Murdoch's sons have, you know, really expressed concern about this for the long-term viability of the company. And I think they're thinking about the same thing at the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. These are business people. I'm not saying something that's ruthless. They're thinking in a ruthless way, right? Because they're capitalists. I mean, and I don't blame them for that, but I'm a capitalist. I mean, we charge people for Quorum Report subscriptions. It's just, you know, the fact of the matter is you can't keep running like that. And if they want to go down the rabbit hole with Trump, it would upend what they've been thinking about long term about the way they would run News Corp.
There are two stories that are connected that you sent me this morning. One was the following. The Texas House has a new presumptive speaker, Dade Phelan.
Think of it like you're feeling it, Arnie.
Yeah, okay, Dade Phelan. I'll get used to his name. Dade Phelan of Beaumont, Texas, is a conservative, but has a history of standing up to Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. There, I'm thinking, oh, I love this. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. Meantime, Texas GOP Chairman Alan West said presumptive Speaker Phelan is a, quote, political traitor, close quote, because he has pledged to work with Democrats. All right, so let's talk a little bit about this new presumptive speaker. Introduce me to him. What's his background? What's the story? What do you see as his potential sort of view of leadership?
Dade Phelan is a creature of the legislature. He's a real estate guy in Southeast Texas in Orange County and Jefferson County. That's the Beaumont, Texas area, east of Houston, almost to Louisiana. So you can get pretty good Cajun food in his district. He's an interesting guy. He worked for Democrats and Republicans as a staffer at the Capitol and then decided he wanted to run for office. Of course, you know, this happens a lot. People get steeped in the political process and legislative process. And he's somebody who last session under Speaker Bonin, who, of course, flamed out after his meeting with the right-wing enforcement group, Empower Texans. We don't have to cover all that again. But he was part of the leadership team. He was the State Affairs Chairman. The State Affairs Committee in the Texas House has been described by veterans of the legislative process. It's the committee where bills either go to because they have to die or because they have to pass. It's the bill that handled the bathroom bill. It's the committee that handled the bathroom bill back in 2017. Often this is the committee that would deal with abortion legislation. It would deal with immigration issues. Thorny stuff goes in front of the State Affairs Committee. I'll give you a quick little story here. There was some legislation that we probably talked about here on the show in 2019. Some folks in the business community, big players in the business community, wanted to see some preemption of local ordinances on employment issues. And those had to do with things like mandatory paid sick leave, scheduling issues, et cetera, things that are important to the workers and to the businesses. They just have different opinions about it. This legislation was hijacked in the Texas Senate by the anti-LGBT crowd. Part of what was injected into the bill was a prohibition on cities and counties adopting equal rights ordinances. Chambers of Commerce were unhappy about this. You remember when the bathroom bill was debated, it was the business community that came out swinging and said, look, this is not good. We need to create a welcoming environment for people to come into Texas. We're always seeing corporate relocations in Texas. Toyota of North America, the headquarters is in Plano, Texas. Exxon has a huge campus down in the Woodlands, Texas. And the people who run those companies would tell you it's hard enough to get the best and brightest from the whole world to move to these places, Plano, Texas, the Woodlands, Texas. If they don't know anything else about it, it's even harder to get people to move there if you put up a big sign that says you and your kids are not welcome here because they're gay. And so they fought back against this. Well, after the bills were passed out of the Texas Senate, it goes over to the Texas House. It goes to the State Affairs Committee where Dade Phelan was the chairman. He did something very interesting. As a veteran of the process, he understood there were things he could do procedurally to screw this up, to defuse the situation. So what he did was, this was sent to his committee as a series of bills, three or four bills that dealt with different parts of employment law. And what he did was he stripped the anti-gay stuff out of a couple of the bills and passed those and left the other ones with the anti-gay stuff in them. He left those in his committee and didn't vote them out. Later, he went on record and said, look, this is the year at the time, this is the year 2019. Beating up on gay people is not something we should be even doing anymore. This is ridiculous. And I can imagine that the lieutenant governor's head was exploding over that because he had been the one pushing this once again and just didn't gain traction in 2019. There were some other examples like that I won't go into all the weeds about it, but there were other examples where Phelan navigated very deftly through the legislative process to ensure that, as I would think, and you would probably agree, some bad things that, you know, some bad bills didn't end up becoming Texas law because of his leadership. We did see where immediately after the election. And Arnie, I was made aware of this on election night. As soon as it was clear that the Republicans were going to hold the majority in the Texas House, which we talked about last week, members of the legislature immediately started calling each other, texting each other on their cell phones, and trying to figure out who they were going to support for Texas House Speaker. By Wednesday at noon, Phelan held a press conference at the Texas Capitol, which I attended, and he said he had gotten sufficient support to be the next Speaker of the House. Alan West, the former Florida congressman, came out with a statement saying that because Phelan had reached out to Democrats to be part of his coalition moving forward, that he was a political traitor. West made the case that since Republicans were able to keep the majority in the House, that whoever's going to be the House Speaker should not be working with Democrats, the radical socialist left, as West put it. Although to call Texas Democrats radical socialists is laughable. Our Democrats are a little different from the ones y'all have in New Hampshire or in Minnesota for the most part. We do have some pretty liberal members as well. But I would say to Phelan's credit, and you know, he is a pretty conservative guy. I'm not going to say otherwise. He's a conservative. But to his credit, when he was asked by me in the press conference last week, just over a week ago now, I asked him, what was the argument that seemed to resonate with the members as you were trying to round up their support?
I was just going to ask you that question. We were on the same wavelength. Go on.
I asked him what made the difference. Why did they decide that you're the guy? And Phelan cited a column that I wrote a few weeks ago. He said, Scott, I'll point to what you wrote. It's that the members of the House don't care as much about whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a liberal or conservative or where you fall on the ideological spectrum of or any of that. It's more about being somebody who's an honest broker in the legislative process, somebody who will say to you, you know, if you have a piece of legislation that you think ought to be passed, go find your votes. I won't get in your way. Or if they're against you, they'll just say that. They'll say, you know, if you're trying to pass something that is, let's say, some, rollback of abortion legislation in Texas or something as a Democrat, Phelan, or any chairman would say, I'm not for you on that. However, if you can find enough votes to pass it, we'll have the debate. That's the kind of leadership that folks are looking for in a legislative body that has 150 members. And how many members are in the New Hampshire House of Representatives? 400 and something?
Yeah, 400. Right.
It's a little more unwieldy, I can imagine. When you have 150 members who are representing 150 very different communities, and some are Republicans or some are Democrats, and some are urban and some are rural, and you know, some are more African American, some are more white, some are more Hispanic, some are just very diverse. They all have different ideas about where Texas ought to be going. And in a legislative process, what you mainly need is somebody who you can trust to oversee the legislative process. And it seems like there are Republicans and Democrats, enough of them, and it looks like all of them at this point, because now he doesn't have any more opposition. We're calling him presumptive speaker now. He was able to make that case, and it's because members of the House know him. I mean, he's been around for a little while, a few sessions, and as I said, he was a staffer for Republican and Democratic lawmakers in the past. They know him, and they trust him, and we'll take the wait-and-see attitude. As somebody ascends in office, as you know, it can change them, or they can change the office, or a little of both.
So I'm listening to you, and what I'm getting from him is that a sense of respect of the membership. And they feel it. And I just a quick sidebar, many people in my audience know that I was brought into the political process by the Republican majority leader who asked me to run for the legislature. And I reminded, this is how we were in the Constitutional Convention, that I wasn't a Republican. In fact, that I was a Democrat, a liberal Democrat. So he said something very powerful to me, which sounds like something you might hear in Texas. He said, Arnie, 75% of what we need to do in the New Hampshire legislature is about what's good for New Hampshire. And 25% of it is probably very partisan. He said, I think we need you there for the 75%. All right. That was the Republican majority leader, everyone, who asked me to run. And that was a sign of respect because he saw my work ethic. He saw I was willing to open and listen. I worked across the aisle and I also learned from folks across the aisle. And as a result of that experience with me for 6 weeks in the Constitutional Convention, it was his invitation to me to actually run for the state legislature.
Made the difference.
However, in 1991, they called him when he had retired to Florida and said, look what you created. Now she's running for governor. Look what you created. But yeah. I just want people to know that was the hand.
Yeah.
Because he said, I respect you. I don't agree with you, but I respect you. And that's important for both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in our state legislatures, and I don't know how it goes everywhere, it sounds like in New Hampshire, y'all still have some of that. In Texas, yeah. for the most part, it's still that for, you know, most of the time. And that's why it's so jarring to people when we do end up having and I've covered it and you've seen it, you know, where you are, it's really jarring to people in a state legislative process when the majority exercises raw power, which they will do. I mean, in 2013, when the Republicans steamrolled Wendy Davis and the Democrats on the abortion legislation, it was an exercise of raw power. And it's not the kind of thing that folks are used to. When the legislature passed the immigration crackdown in 2017, it was an exercise of raw power. And you saw people, just their nerves were frayed. You would have thought that they would never, I mean, people that they are friends with, they're ripping each other up. And you'd have thought they'd never talk to each other again after that. But, you know, wounds heal over time. And you go back to the 75% where you're just trying to do what's good for the state.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. That is Scott Braddock. He's the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And if it's Friday, it must be Scott. We'll talk next week. Ciao.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around.
Insight Daily Radio. Winston Groom is the beloved author of 19 books, including Forrest Gump, The Aviators, Conversations with the Enemy, and The Generals. This fall actually marks the 25th anniversary of the release of Forrest Gump, the movie. His latest book is The Allies, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, and the unlikely alliance that won World War II. This new book tells one of the biggest stories of the 20th century, how the three great Allied leaders, Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, and Joseph Stalin, emerged to control the war in the Pacific and Europe. We spoke with him about his new book.
Well, the alliance was extremely tight throughout the war, but Roosevelt died before a couple of months before the war ended. When the war ended, Churchill was turned out of office, and so you had entirely different people. For instance, the Potsdam Conference, which was essentially the conference where Europe was divvied up amongst the communist and non-communist states. And I don't know, there's no way to tell what would have happened if each man had remained alive, but what did happen was the Soviet Russia simply took what they wanted and kept it for, 40, 50 years.
That's Winston Groom, the author of The Allies, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, and the Unlikely Alliance that won World War II. It will be released on November 13th, out in time for Veterans Day and before the 75th anniversary of D-Day in June 2019. Insight Daily Radio.
If you could only see me, I know exactly where I am. You wouldn't want to be me. Oh, I can assure you that.
me gain control before I lose my reason and my soul. He's King Midas with a curse. He's King Midas in reverse. He's King Midas with a curse. He's King Midas in reverse. He's King Midas with a curse.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. If it's Friday, it's Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for the great governor position in the state of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He worked on the nuclear freeze movement. He has written for Salon.com. He is a go-to person when you want to sort of do analysis of the world that is devolving around you politically. And he does it through a thoughtful and progressive lens. And I always value his voice. So let me welcome back Bill Curry to the program. Thank you so much, Bill, for joining.
Thank you.
One of the things I said to you was like, what do you want to talk about? And you said, let's talk about the coup. And I'm like, yeah, I see it too. You see it? Explain to my audience why you wanted to start there. Because everything around me just feels so toxic. I actually just posted a story about sort of a coup-like event that happened in Europe. And I said, read what happened here and look what's happening here. It feels the same. Okay, this is like a story from like 2011. Tell me why you say you want to talk about the coup and what you see as sort of the pivotal parts that we are watching and trying to understand. And at the same time, I feel, Bill, we are not responding correctly to what we are seeing. That's my biggest fear. It's not that a coup isn't potentially happening, but I don't think we know how to respond to what we see.
You know, there were a lot of good books written about autocracy, totalitarianism, Snyder's book, you know, what are the warning signs? Madeleine Albright had a book about fascism, and they were all helpful. None of them came out and said, by the way, there's fascism right here. Now, this isn't like the early warning signs. We missed those a few years ago. And the very fact that none of those books suggested that America had elected a fascist president made them, in my mind, less worthwhile. Because they each failed to do the very thing they were urging people to do, which is name it, see it, name it, speak up, engage it. And we still haven't done enough of that. And a lot of this is, again, how we debate. This is the ancient history of fascism, that whenever it comes along, that the liberal establishment, broadly defined, the liberal, you know, economic and political order, doesn't have the tools or the protocols or the guts to engage it and call it for what it is. In 2015 and 2016, no mainstream media used the word lie to discuss the falsehoods spewing from Trump. The first time the New York Times used the word lie to describe something Trump said was after the election, when it was too late. And it was on the question of birtherism when Trump finally did a press conference saying, you know, I guess it wasn't true. And even he said it wasn't true, but that was the first time they could use the word lie. Of course, now everyone uses the word lie about Trump. Stephen Colbert, Michelle Goldberg, a handful of people have used the word fascist. I wrote about this in Salon a couple of years back, that he checks every box for fascist just as surely as he does for malignant narcissism. We got over the word lie. We got over the word narcissist. And it's too bad we didn't get over the word fascism, because there's a global fascist movement for which Donald Trump is the pinup boy. There is no rational reason for any thinking person to believe that Trump wouldn't go further than he's gone. This morning was another in the Washington Post, another story in which Trump aides confided to off the record to the Washington Post reporter with them, using them as contacts, not a wise strategy to begin with, that don't worry, Trump's doing all this and saying all this, but he has no real plan. He's not really going to actually refuse to hand over power. He has no real plan for contesting the election. Everything he's doing right now, lawyers should actually be disbarred for. You know, you can be fined for a frivolous lawsuit. Well, these are the ultimate pernicious frivolous lawsuits.
Right.
I mean, they really ought to pay, I don't know, disbarred bar, but they ought to pay a real price for it. Everything he's doing, from Barr telling the prosecutors to investigate alleged irregularities, one, that's never been done before for a good reason, in the specific context of election law alleged violations. But two, it isn't done with anything.
Yeah.
Okay, it's just not done, period. The conversations they've had with legislators about refusing to seat the duly elected electors, the only thing that would stop Trump from doing that is if he's refused, if they won't do it. He'll try to do it. There's nothing he wouldn't do. You know, Trump's not Hitler. He's not a Nazi. He's just a fascist. He's not Hitler, but he's gaining on Mussolini, and he left Juan Perón in the rearview mirror years ago. And that's who it is. We elected a fascist. The one piece of this that's good, and again, we've learned two things. The bad thing we've learned is how few people care about democracy itself, how few people understand democracy. America has a very stunted understanding of democracy. Our culture is failing to pass on an appreciation for it. Part of it is we just don't teach enough civics and history, and we don't teach it honestly enough. We would become a more democratic citizenry, which is a vital objective of our society. I said the establishment doesn't have the tools to deal with this, and neither does the general public.
So the story I posted was...
And neither does the Democratic Party.
Oh,
and
God.
I just want to add one thing, and I'll stop. And that is that the good news, Trump can't steal the election, so he's trying to murder the democracy, was always, always front and center for the Putins, Bolsonaros, Tertes, yep. Erdogans, all these people. That's what they hate. They hate democracy. They hate democracy the way the Grinch hated Christmas, okay? And it's not going to end the same way that story did. Okay. Now that he's gone,
now
Jan 20th will be gone. And one thing we should all participate in is a campaign to get people to use the word fascist. They didn't want to use it against the president, but if we could just label the movement for what it is, people have a right to know what team they're suiting up for. You know, and it's the fascist team, and it ought to be clearly designed that it is anti-democratic. And then we begin to explain, you don't incite your crowds to violence. You don't incite police to violence. You know, you just don't do all these things. You don't use the Justice Department and all the instrumentalities of government to persecute your opponents or anybody who ever disagreed with you. Amazon, Facebook, they're using the government in every way to subjugate every sector of the society. And they're doing it to whatever extent we'll let them. There's no sense of the boundary. So if we could just begin to go back now and find the right language to discuss the problem we're having.
I went back to an article. This is from a long time ago. Photos document brutal Turkish takeover of Kurdish village. Now, why did I do this? And I wrote, this story from years ago reminds me of Donald as he leaves Washington. Thousands dead from the pandemic, a government being dismantled as he leaves office, and a country withering from the schism demanded by Trump, even as both sides are dying from his denial of science and raging disease. Brutality is tactics seen around the world. Now we are living our version of it. It's exactly what I posted this morning.
That really resonates for me. It's also because, you know, one of the things that we don't, when people are in therapy, one of the things you learn in therapy is that the wonderful, I read this from a wonderful British psychiatrist and writer, Anthony Storr, mm-hmm. who described the process of therapy. And he said, the first thing you do is bring things you didn't know were happening within you to your conscious awareness. You bring from the unconscious through the denial to the awareness. And at that point, they have less power over you. Mm-hmm. He said, then the next step is that you name them. And naming things gives them less power over you. So that's the second stage. And the third stage, he said, was actually living through re-experiencing the traumas and so forth. But that piece about naming, and you have to tell people what's happening when it's happening.
Right.
You know, one of the things we have to look forward to, Trump helped Biden a lot in the debates by setting the bar so low for a year that when Biden came out and didn't drool on his bib, it was a victory right there. And Biden actually did pretty well, did better in those debates than a lot of us were thinking he might. Right. The performance was better than that, but that's all he had to do. They've done the same thing for the Biden administration. They've set the bar so low by describing the horrors to come. If Biden wins, the streets will be filled with looting and arson and violence. And no, the streets were filled with looting and arson and violence because we had a race-baiting president. As soon as the election was over, the violence subsided about 95%. And in fact, what happened in the streets? Everybody was dancing. The looting pictures were replaced with dancing pictures. It was so moving, even if you weren't a Democrat, it was so moving to see people celebrating so joyously and without apparent rancor of any kind. We need to stop and realize that we can't count on the electorate to make that connection. We have to stop and say, look at this, okay? Right. I can't wait for 3 or 4 more months to go by and to ask some of the people I know who supported Trump, hey, how do you like living in Caracas? You know, now that the whole, I guess the whole society's falling apart now, we're living under communist rule. How's it working out for you? And what would be the examples of it that bother you the most? We have to explain that to people. And then, of course, we're going to have to do a much better job of explaining everything we want the government to do. I'm very optimistic about what's possible here, even with Mitch in control of the Senate.
We've been talking this week a lot about personnel as policy. We've been talking about executive orders. We've talked a lot about that. But I am going to bring a lament to you. And I've talked a little bit with Scott Braddock about it. I just was in the union leader today talking about it. And that's what happened down ballot. And the problem with my party, I think, is that they focus too much on what happens in D.C. And they have less respect for what happens at the state level. Somehow they think if they get the presidency that they can fix us. And, you know, the presidency is important, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, when you realize all the responsibility and all the burdens, including on elections, Bill Curry, what have we learned this election cycle is that elections are the province, not just of the states, but of the counties. And sometimes it's not even the province of the counties. It's the province of the election officer in the little individual town. It is so autonomous and it's an accident of geography, whether you wait online 9 hours or you get in 9 minutes. Whatever reason, we haven't recognized the power of the court and appointments to the bench. We haven't recognized that state legislatures matter. And we're always looking at Washington and not what's happening in places like Montpelier, in places like Hartford. And I am so disappointed in our inability to grasp that, you know what, we're supposed to be the worker people's party. Well, if you're the worker people party, then you definitely have to look down ballot, not just up ballot. But they fail to do it over and over. And the sense of disappointment is overwhelming.
I strongly agree. There are 2 points I want to make. The first of which is, as I felt last year, watching all those national security and diplomatic officials testify, not even a year ago. And I was so proud of civil servants. They made me proud to be an American. Many of them were Republicans. Many were people whom I don't agree on most things. But they were like, you know, I've often said, a balanced, thoughtful, conservative judge, I have no problem in that person's courtroom. I don't care. I really, you know, I'll still believe I can get a fair shake. These ideologues and apparatchiks that are being appointed at the top, it's amazing that Trump, the ultimate gaslighter, is now trying to create his own deep state and having failed to find one. But over the election, I thought of those, the people, Vindman and Maria Yovanovitch. I thought of all those people and how proud I was of them. And I'm just so proud of every registrar and clerk and poll worker in America.
Thank you.
And he wasn't able to talk about reaching up and reaching down. We're where we are right now. Clearly, the two Georgia senators are not people we could count on to safeguard our democracy. But all those people who've always acted in a bipartisan way, in all the town halls across this country, your Republican and Democratic registrars, your town clerk, regardless of party, they've taken a great pride in being public servants. And I just urge people who are inclined to scapegoat public employees for the sins of the politicians who created the systems they must labor in, or to believe conspiracy theories of any kind, that those people are the people as much as anyone who saved this democracy by their professionalism, by their integrity, by their bravery in many cases. And so I'm just very proud of that. And I do think that this thing is moving our way in lots of ways. Is Trump going to set up a new network, a new television network to challenge Rupert Murdoch? Is he going to run for re-election? We're worried because Trumpism is still going to survive. And by the way, it'll survive even longer, so long as we call it Trumpism rather than fascism. Will Trump stay around? I hope Trump hangs around. He thinks he's starting a new television network. What, between depositions? He's going to be filing for bankruptcy. I wouldn't be surprised if Melania did some filing of her own. He has all these legal actions that are pending against him. He has all this debt. He leaves the White House for a world of hurt. And again, people are going to be able to watch two things now. Our ability to change the political balance is going to reflect how well we govern, what people learn from the examples. And we're luckily going to have two examples at once. everything about Trump is about to become public. And that's going to be one bad day after another. And everything we try to do, if we frame it correctly, we do the things we can do on climate change, corruption, national security, foreign affairs, where Biden has a lot of latitude. We fight for the budget where we've got the House and the White House. That's the Democratic formula. If you've got two-thirds of the budget-making power, you might get close to half of what you want. That's how we are. We're not good negotiators. But as we do all that, we have to realize that part of what happened down ballot does reflect, as you say, the inattention toward grassroots organizing, complete inattention to grassroots organizing in non-Washington politics of the Democratic Party. And as I've often said, the Democratic National Committee could screw up a two-car funeral. They're never going to fix themselves. They're never going to make it better. But it also reflects the genuine, delicate balance of power between left and right in this country. And we still have to come back to, we have to focus more on grassroots organizing. I was on a call with Jim Dean last night, who's the founder of Democracy for America, talking to our Connecticut DFA chapter. And, you know, asking him, because he has such experience in this, what can we do to take some of the organizations we have and create a body that does what the DNC is supposed to do, that focuses completely on local grassroots, face-to-face. And if we could take Obama for America, what's left of that legacy institution, and the Bernie stuff, and maybe some of the freestanding places, and maybe get a Stacey Abrams. I'd rather see her running that organization than sitting in a cabinet. And if we could transform our politics into small donor, face-to-face, grassroots politics through their efforts, it would be a great, great step forward. But at the same time, we have to recognize that people don't want everything we're selling. They certainly don't want everything that Donald Trump told them we're selling. We have to do a way better job of explaining ourselves, because he branded the Democratic Party time and time again, and we failed at every level, progressives as well as establishment Democrats, to make the case that we needed to make for our programs and to answer those questions, I can say that every voter, not just Republicans, has. How much does it cost? How does it really work? Will you keep me safe? These are things we have to show people that are progressive. These are questions that have progressive answers, but we got to spell them out and then repeat it 100 times. We have to tell the truth just as often as they lie, or we're going to lose.
So I have a question for you. Because I keep hearing on MSNBC, and they bring in some of the Democrats that did win who are blaming progressives. And one of the arguments that they use is the fact that we have become associated with defund the police. Maybe refresh my recollection, but after what happened to George Floyd, after what happened in many cities around the country, where we saw the police exercise a level of brutality that we've been told about, but now we got to see, okay, we get to see it. So we've heard the response being defund the police. I'm just wondering, did that emerge from a group of progressives, or did the Black Lives Matter community, so exhausted by never being heard about how the police have sort of exercised a form of racism and have targeted them for generations, suddenly said, maybe the way to get attention is to say, defund them, because what they are not officers of the peace. They are not our protectors. They are people who basically make an assumption about us because of the color of our skin, that somehow we are not worthy of protection, that we are like the example of blame. I'm just trying to figure out, where did the language defund the police come from? And isn't it interesting that all these moderates basically point to every progressive in America? And I think that the language of defund the police came with the exhaustion of what's happening within the Black community and their inability to have a relationship with the police that doesn't target them.
I think that's true, but it's still a bad idea.
Oh, I don't disagree.
Yeah, I know. We've talked about this before. And I would just say that there's a lot of this. I tell people the Democratic Party can't afford to let Bruce Springsteen be the only person speaking sympathetically to the white working class.
Right.
And when it's hard for us to do that, we should just think of them all as characters in a Springsteen song or the Grapes of Wrath. But we should remember that there are lots of people hurting in lots of ways. Exactly. And that the goal of all true progressive movements has been to get everybody on the same bus.
Right.
And again, that will you keep me safe? We lost a lot of Latino and Black votes because of their feelings about law and order. There are good answers to those questions. We'll save it for another show, but there are good answers to those questions. But we have to start making them. And Black Lives Matter and all the advocates, it's done great things. And I given one of the few things I've ever given money to in the last few years, a few causes I thought, you know, well enough of. At the same time, I don't always agree with how they frame this stuff. I don't want to talk to people about white privilege. I don't want to talk about systemic racism. I'd rather talk about, you know, or implicit racism. I'd rather talk about unconscious prejudice than implicit racism, because implicit means that they're meaning to imply it when they don't know they're doing that. I don't want to talk to people in a way that makes them think that I think I'm morally superior. It doesn't mean I want to pander or evade or let it go or drop a single issue, but I want to talk to them the way Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Mandela and Vaclav Havel and all the people I loved and admired from the 20th century, progressives of all kinds, with respect. Every progressive in America should read Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail and see the amount of respect expressed. And we should always remember that if you want to teach morality, you should remember your own shortcomings and realize that the only effective way to teach it is by example. And so we've started, when the first round of Black Lives Matter began to spring up, 80-odd% of the American people wanted to put cameras on police. And that's dropped a lot because they didn't like the way we were talking to them. And you have to reach out in a lot of this stuff. And lastly, this whole search for slogans. I mean, a lot of the things we do as progressives, we do for our own catharsis. I think sometimes when we're talking to our base more than to undecided voters. You can make the same point. I'm not saying pull in your horns. I'm saying remember who you're talking to. And remember how many of them are your own relatives. Think of how hard it was for same-sex marriage, for gay people to come out to their families and teach gently. And how that rocketed us toward marriage equality. It's so much faster than most of us thought could happen. And think of that as a model for how we all try to teach one another in a way as loving members of a family. On those issues, we have to do that. There are no progressive slogans. In all of American history, there are no progressive slogans. The women's movement didn't have a slogan. I was the political director of the nuclear freeze movement. We didn't have one. Neither did the consumer movement or the civil rights movement. Almost every American political slogan is reactionary and conceived by reactionaries. 54-40 or fight, remember the Maine, run Romanism and rebellion. Everyone you can name was concocted by some little mini fascist and then caught fire. And the reason is that they need that. That is where their appeals lie. They don't have the facts on their side or the truth or logic on their side. People don't change based on that kind of thing. Most of our pollsters and consultants and the Lakoffs and Weston, they got this all wrong. Every progressive movement that's ever worked in this country, and think of all the wonderful ones we've had, did it by making a fact-based, reasoned, value-based argument to the whole country at once, not micro-targeted or niche-marketed. We made the same argument, and we have to decide as progressives what that argument is. And, you know, at the nuclear freeze movement, Randy Forsberg and Randy Keeler, these wonderful people who started it, and it was Randy Forsberg, I think, late Randy Forsberg. I think that she was the person who came up with the actual language for it. But it was the moment at which they caught the formula. It was just before I got there. They did. I wasn't part of this, but you know that it was. What did we want? We wanted a bilateral, verifiable freeze on the research, production, and deployment of nuclear weapons. That was our slogan, pretty complicated slogan. But we made that case. And people thought, okay, bilateral, verifiable, no more nukes. You know, when I had the privilege, actually, of meeting Michael Deaver, who was Reagan's top advisor, I spent a great time, had a few meetings with him late in his life. And he was an extraordinary person. When I met him in a reception in Washington, I walked up, I said, you know, in 1984, I had two jobs. One was establishing immediate world peace, and the other was defeating Ronald Reagan for re-election. And I decided when I left that job that next time I would just try one, you know. And he turned to me and he said, that's funny because I had two jobs in 1984. One was reelecting Ronald Reagan and the other was to keep my mother from sending you money. And we hit it off. And he said to me, and it's true, and Reagan did things that back this up. Reagan heard the argument. Reagan went to Reykjavik and tried to cashier the entire nuclear weapon system. And while I was going around telling people how horrible Reagan was, and he did a lot of horrible things, I don't mean to revisit that, but Deaver, who was his closest advisor, the closest person in the world to him except for Nancy, said Reagan agreed wholeheartedly with the freeze movement and only criticized it for not going far enough. Wow. And he went much further in the end than we did. No one remembers that about him, or few people do.
What a great piece of history. All right,
but you make the argument that just so you want to convert somebody? come up with solutions to problems that they suffer from, and make arguments that are broad and logical and clear, and make them 1,000 times over, and make them face-to-face, make them grassroots. We can take the whole thing here.
If it's Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry joins us every Friday, and now you know why. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Thank you for joining us this week. We will schmooze on Monday. Ciao. You bet. Change.